Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we visit the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown for a conversation between authors Joan Wickersham and Alicia Abbott, recorded as part of a series sponsored by 20 Summers. Both women have written critically acclaimed memoirs about their fathers they loved and lost too soon. In Fairyland, which won an ALA Stonewall Award, Abbott chronicles her Haight-Ashbury upbringing with an openly bisexual father who succumbed to AIDS. Wickersham's The Suicide Index, a National Book Award finalist, is a moving and often surprisingly humorous account of how she and her family coped with the aftermath of her father's suicide. The two authors discuss their memoirs, their writing lives, and their other work.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us and to everyone involved in this series. I'm really honored to be here, and I'm very honored to be here with Alicia. We thought that we would begin by just each reading just a little bit of our memoirs so that you could get a taste of the subject matter and the voice of the memoir, and then we would have our conversation. So I'm going to begin. My book, as Julie said, which has an ant crawling on it, is called The Suicide Index, and it's a book about my father died in 1991, and I'm just going to read the beginning. The first chapter is called Suicide, Act of, Attempt to Imagine. In the airport, coming home from vacation, he stops at a kiosk and buys grapefruits, which he arranges to have sent to his daughters. They will stumble over the crates waiting on their porches when they get home from his funeral. It's the last week of his life. Does he know that? At some point, yes. At the moment when his index finger closes on the trigger of the gun, he knows it with certainty. But before that, even a moment before, when he sat down in the chair holding the gun, was he sure? Perhaps he's done this much before, once or many times, held the gun, loaded the gun, but then stopped himself. No. When does he know that this time he will not stop? What about the gun? Has it been an itch, a temptation, the hidden chocolates in the bureau drawer? Did he think about it daily? Did it draw him? Did he have to resist it? Perhaps the thought of it has been comforting. Well, remember, I can always do that. Or maybe he didn't think about the gun and how it might be used. There was just that long, deep misery, an occasional flicker, I want to stop everything, always instantly snuffed out, too difficult. How would I do it? Even the question exhausts me. And then one day the flicker caught fire, burned brightly for a moment, just long enough to see by. Oh yes, the gun, the old gun on the closet shelf with the sweaters. He didn't do it that day. He put away the thought. He didn't even take the gun down, look at it, hold it in his hands. That would imply he was thinking of actually doing it, and he would never actually do such a thing. Some days the gun sings to him. Other days, more often, he doesn't hear it. Maybe on those stronger days, he has considered getting rid of it, take it to a gun shop, turn it into the police. But then someone else would know he has a gun, and it's no one else's business. He hasn't wanted to deal with their questions. Where did you get it? How long have you had it? Besides, how long has he had it? 20 years? 25? And never fired it in all that time? So where's the danger? What's the harm in keeping it around, letting it sleep there among the sweaters? He doesn't even know where the bullets are, for God's sake. But immediately, involuntarily, he does know. He knows exactly which corner of which drawer. We have to watch him from the outside. He leaves no clues. His whole life is a clue. What is he thinking when he gets up that last morning, showers, and dresses for work? He puts on a blue and white striped cotton shirt, a pair of brown corduroys, heavy brown shoes, a tan cashmere sweater. He has joked to his daughter that all the clothes he buys these days are the color of sawdust. Might as well be, he said. They end up covered in the stuff anyhow, in the machinery business. So he has shaved, patted on aftershave, and climbed into his dun-colored clothes. He's gone to his dresser and loaded his pockets. Change, wallet, keys, handkerchief. Maybe he thinks he's going to work. Or maybe he knows, hopes, that in 45 minutes he'll be dead. It's Friday morning. He's just doing what he does every morning, getting ready. He may be thinking about it on the walk down the long driveway to get the newspaper. The cold, dry air gripping the sides of his head. The ice cracking under his feet as he tramps along this driveway he can no longer quite afford. Is there something in the newspaper? The front page is the only one in question, since he leaves the paper on the kitchen table folded and unread. More bombings. All this week he's been sitting in front of the television in the evenings, staring at the news. Silent films of Baghdad buildings, fine white-lined crosses, zigzagging dizzily over their facades, zooming in and centering. Then a long moment, just that white cross holding steady. And then the building falls down. No sound, no smoke or flash of light, just caves in. And that's it. The screen goes blank. The camera doesn't wait around to gloat. Then another building, another filmed implosion. We're getting all these places, relentlessly. We're hunting them down and getting them. What has he been thinking about this week, watching these films over and over? The silent buildings that simply implode. The front page of the paper is full of the war, but nothing else that's major. No market crash, nothing that would lead directly or indirectly to his losing more than he has already lost, which is virtually everything. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's what he is thinking, not just on this last morning, but all the time. You've lost everything, not at a single blow, but gradually, over years, a small hole in a sandbag. You see the hole clearly, but you have no way to fix it. No one but you has been aware of that thin, sawdust-colored stream of sand escaping. But now enough sand has leaked that the shape of the bag is changing. It's collapsing. It will be noticed. You will be caught. And then, you don't know what. You want not to be here when that happens. He makes the pot of regular coffee for his wife, fills a cup, carries it upstairs to her bedside table. The fact that he doesn't make his own usual pot of decaf might mean that he's already decided. Or it might mean that he generally makes that second pot when he comes downstairs again. And this morning, he doesn't go downstairs again. He stands at his wife's side of the bed and looks at her, sleeping. He looks at her for a long time. Or maybe he doesn't look. Maybe he puts down the saucer and goes for the gun and is out of the room before the coffee stops quivering in the cup.
Thank you. I'm also honored to read with Joan tonight, and we'll read just a short excerpt from early in the memoir, Fairyland. When I remember Dad now, I mostly remember his innocence, his sweetness, his gentle manner. He wasn't tough. None of the tragedy he'd known, losing his wife in a car accident, feeling rejected by family and lovers. None of this had hardened him in any way that I could tell. His hands were soft. He had pale skin and freckles. He burned easily in the sun, so he generally avoided it. As a little girl home from the first grade and resigned to cozying up to the television for company as my dad worked on his poems and cartoons, I developed a crush on Mr. Rogers. He was so like my dad, with his slender shoulders, brown hair, and light eyes, the careful way he removed his loafers and laced his sneakers, his gentle manner of speaking and inviting you into his life. Every day he sang me a song, and every day I answered him, "Yes, I will. I will be your neighbor." You could hear Nebraska whenever my father opened his mouth. His conversations were peppered with folksy sayings and examples of the dry wit he'd admired in his grandma folk. Widowed young and never remarried, she cared for two children on a schoolteacher's salary and helped raise my father until my grandfather returned from the Second World War. "If you burn yourself," she used to tell him, "you gotta sit on the blister." I used to tease him, the way he pronounced cafe, cafe, the way he called the remote control the clicker, or the way he called every pasta dish we ate spaghetti. Instead of differentiating between linguine, fettuccine, and angel hair, as I had learned to do, a San Francisco sophisticate. When he said okie dokie and smiled his toothy grin, it sounded old-fashioned and silly. Sometimes his more literary friends would make fun of him. They laughed when at a fancy dinner, Dad told them a story about his childhood dog, Sparky. But the quirkiness of his speech, as much as I teased him for it, just made him more of the dad I loved. Dad's sweetness and easy manner charmed people and animals alike. Whenever we were at a party or at someone's house for dinner, whatever cat was around would inevitably end up on Dad's lap, purring away while he stroked its fur absentmindedly. At many of these parties, I was the cat, always drawn to his lap, always calmed by his breathing, his vibrating chest and soft voice. And on his lap, he would also pet me with those gentle, loving hands. I have pictures of him at age 8. His parents used to drive him and his younger sister from Lincoln to Denver every summer. In Estes Park, you could feed chipmunks with peanuts sold by the bag at the park entrance. In one picture, he's crouched perfectly still, his hand balanced on a boulder, his fingers outstretched, clasping a peanut. And at the end of that peanut, a tiny chipmunk nibbles away while my father looks content and serene. In the background, his younger sister, Elaine, is in bangs and pigtails, her mouth open, mid-complaint. No matter how much she tried to tempt the chipmunks with her swaying peanut, they were always drawn to Dad. As a child, I loved looking at pictures of my father's boyhood in Lincoln. There he is riding a bicycle. There he is playing Pony Express and circus with the neighborhood kids. The scenes of my father captured so diligently by Grandpa Abbott looked to me right out of the shows that aired every afternoon on TV. Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best. Grandpa scribbled titles on the photo backs too. Dancing Steve, First Communion, Taking Time Out for Refreshments. These titles unwittingly masked quiet unhappiness I only understood after reading my dad's journals. When some people age, you can see a history of disappointment in their face and posture. A smile is creased in the corner as though it painfully swallowed an unpleasant truth. Sad eyes slant and sag. Cheeks grow pale. Shoulders slump as if weary from carrying the burden of grief, guilt, or an unresolved hurt. But look at a photo of the same person as a child, and you may see someone else entirely, someone full of lightness and joy, and that peculiar, almost stupid hope that can only come from inexperience. My grandmother, Munka, she talked about that stupid hope. It was maybe for this reason she avoided looking at herself, pictures of herself when she was young. I once asked about her wedding portrait, which we didn't find until after she died. I don't know where it is, she said. I think I saw it once and thought, that stupid girl, she doesn't know what she's in for. My father also didn't know what he was in for as a grown-up, but that stupid hope came later. And pictures of him as an adult in San Francisco with his arms slung around the neck of a young boyfriend, or pulling me onto his lap in a cluttered apartment kitchen. He looks relaxed, almost giddy. Posed among a group of illustrious writers in the basement of City Lights bookstore, he appears content and proud. Standing on Haight Street in his beard, fedora, and 1940s top coat, he looks in his element, like a king surveying his lands, unaware of the invaders at the gate. You find a different Steve in the Nebraska pictures. As a three-year-old, he already looks uncertain. As a child of seven, he's often looking away from the camera, while his sister will be smiling and looking straight on. In another photograph, a close-up of him in an Indian headdress leaning against a tree, he sneers. In his eyes, there's an aggressive snarl that seems deeper than the typical pretend play of children. In pictures with his parents, I rarely see affection. His body is stiff next to his mother in a parking lot somewhere in Colorado. Both of them are looking away as though trying to find their real families. In the family album, I see, in fact, that no one in my father's family hugs. They rarely touch. Hands are in laps or at sides, clenched into loose fists. My father never officially came out to his parents. Helen and Jean Abbott learned their son was gay by reading a letter Dad had written to his brother David, which had been left out on the table. But they'd long been suspicious. Dad wasn't able to be himself, his true self, his naked and profane self, until he left Lincoln for Atlanta and then San Francisco. And once he came out, he was fully out. He could never go back in.
You're listening to The Point, where today we bring you a conversation with authors Joan Wickersham and Alicia Abbott from the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. We'll have more after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. Today, a discussion with authors Joan Wickersham and Alicia Abbott from the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown.
So we're just going to continue tonight. We are both recently read each other's work and are very excited to finally have an opportunity to ask each other questions. In fact, at one point, Joan and I were emailing saying, should we get on the phone and talk about, you know, what we're going to say? And Joan rightly said, no, I know we're dying to talk about all these things. Let's keep it fresh. Let's not say anything until it, so we both are kind of bursting. But I can just start with something. One thing that's really interesting to me that suicide's one of the few ways you can die that it's a noun in addition to a verb. You know, you can commit suicide, but you are a suicide. Whereas if you're murdered, you're not a murderer. You know, the manner of death is a definition. And so I just wondered if you might comment on maybe the desire you had to, you know, fight against this determinism of the word.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because I thought about this when I was reading your book, that for both of us, our father's deaths, you know, it's a personal, terrible experience. But they both had a larger context in a way. I think I was drawn to write about my father, you know, partly as a personal thing and partly because I'm a writer and that's how writers operate. You know, something happens and you write about it. But what I feel about suicide that was really hard is I felt that immediately after my father died, the way people spoke about him changed. You know, it was sort of like suddenly he was this guy who had done this thing. And it was hard because I remembered him as my wonderful, gentle, lovely, funny father. And it was like this clump thing came down on him that was suicide. He was a suicide. And I think part of my desire in writing the book was to restore some of him to his personhood. But I also felt that there was something about suicide that gets directly in between the person and your memory of the person. And I think there's a way with suicide that I was struggling with. The world suddenly thought this thing about my father, and I didn't want to think this thing about my father, but it did change, you know, my sense of who he was, because I suddenly realized he was very secretive. He hid his depression. He had no diagnosis, no treatment. It threw into question all my memories of him, and I think there's a way that that's part of what I'm writing about in the book, about the nature of this kind of suicide that comes with no warning. One reason I think the grief goes on for so long and never really can resolve itself is that you can't think of that person for a really long time without thinking of the manner of his death. And I think that the reason the book ended up being a memoir rather than a novel, for years I was working on it as a novel, but I think it ended up as a memoir because I think the suicide really interfered with memory. And that was the place that I had to work through it as a memoir.
And in your memoir, you do such a beautiful job, too, sort of taking these contradictions. Even in the part you read, you said, he leaves no clue, his whole life is a clue. And that kind of, at once, the fact that you thought you knew him, you didn't know him at all. And what didn't you know?
Yeah, but then I'm curious with your father, because he left a lot of clues. He left writings and letters, poems. You know, one of the things that struck me is that your book is not only a memoir, but it's also really an artistic biography of your father and of his work. And I'm curious what it was like for you to remember him doing those things when you were a child, but then also going back as an adult and as a writer to revisit his work.
My father died of AIDS when I was 21. And during his lifetime, I was always aware of his writing, but his writing really played the role of competitor for his attentions. And I had sometimes a hostile relationship with his writing where I just said, I don't want you to go out tonight. I want you to stay home. Or I think I even, you know, wrote him a letter, a short story when I was 10 about how he was suddenly so successful that there was a presidential campaign and they were reading his poem, but he decided that nothing was so important as his daughter and he left it all behind. And, you know, it was just like... And I called the, you know, the title was Sudden Success. You know, but he never had, and, you know, that was the other thing that was sort of interesting is, you know, in a very strange way, in his lifetime, because he published in small presses and small circles, through the publication of my memoir, I was actually able to get him a much larger audience for his writing than he ever knew in his life, which felt to me like a gift I could sort of give to him posthumously, to have his work translated into French, for example, which culture was very meaningful to him. But it was interesting to have to, you know, you think you know someone, you're like, oh, this is my father, I know him so well, I've read his letters, you know, this is, I've watched him die, there's no more of an intimacy than that, yet to revisit that life 20 years later, and then from this perspective of, like, what was he working on, actually? And what was he thinking? And what were his friendships like? And you know, his relationships beyond, you know, the father-daughter relationship, it was, you know, that was a whole new experience. I mean, I thought what was, you know, what's sort of challenging when you are sort of trying to be both a biographer and a memoirist is the struggle to sort of get it right, to sort of produce a portrait that would feel true somehow and real. As you are engaging in that, you know that it's basically impossible to some extent. There's no way you could create someone as full as you know them. And so you're sort of working against this attempt. But, you know, two, I think, is the challenge, and I think you handled it really beautifully, of, you know, the different relationships that define that person. And so in my instance with my dad, I was an only child, and my mother died when I was 2.5. And there wasn't, at the point of his death, there wasn't a significant lover in his life. There were some friends. But I approached this book feeling like, this is my story to tell. I have no one else's version to sort of, you know, work in, against me. That I and as well, I think I felt this sort of birthright. Like, I was left these journals. He knew that. This was the reward I got for losing him, was the ability to tell his story the way I wanted to. Like, I sort of took it that way. How challenging for you that would have been to be writing this at the time of, you know, with your sister having her own version of events and your mother having her own version of events. And how do you tell a story and try to reach some truth while accommodating those other points of view? And there was this beautiful part, I'll just to quote it, it was just really interesting, where you'll say, I know my mother is dying to tell this part of the story, so let me let her tell it. And then you'll suddenly quote her. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, I feel like you were making these accommodations.
Yeah, although I'm not actually quoting her. I'm sort of fictionalizing, you know, what I'm really fictionalizing my version of what I think her version is, you know? So it's, but you know, it's very interesting, Alicia, that, you know, this is such a classic question of memoirists. You know, when I'm teaching nonfiction, there's this moment where the room gets really quiet and then someone goes, how do you write a memoir without hurting anyone? And, you know, the answer is, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Memoirs always feel dangerous if they're done right. I mean, I think your case is very unusual where there aren't people to be hurt. But I think it's tricky because you have to, if you're writing about a situation that's a mess, you have to actually let it be a mess on the page. You can't clean it up so much that you're being untrue to the experience. But at the same time, you don't want to put every piece of dirty laundry on the page, because that is gratuitously mean, first of all, to the people around you. And second, frankly, even if I look at it just coldly as a reader and writer, I have read memoirs sometimes where I just feel like they're working out a grievance on the page. Mm. And I think there's a way that the stance of the narrative is very important. You know, and I think I'll ask you this too. How you get the stance right is very tricky. I know that with the Suicide Index, I overwrote initially. There was a lot of stuff in there that I was, you know, angry about and got into a draft. And then as I went through successive drafts, I took some things out because I just realized it made me feel much better to write them, but nobody else needed to read them, and they didn't. They were not necessary to the story. I think that is tricky, but I did also have that birthright feeling. I felt that there's a way that, you know, my father's death was a major cataclysm, and I just felt like I had a right to tell the story. But I had to go very gently among my family afterward, and it took, you know, some people were more upset about it than others. Some people chose not to read it, which I think is fine. I think that's actually a wise response sometimes, just to say, I'm sorry, I can't read this. And I didn't tell anyone that I was working on it while I was working on it. But one thing I'm dying to ask you about with narrative stance, because I thought when I was reading your book, I loved the way you got on the page yourself as a little kid, yourself as a teenager, being grumpy often with your father, you know, and I took the grumpiness as part of the love, you know, that it was just, what I love is there's such a close relationship on the page in your book. I really feel like you and your father are not always pleasant to each other, but you're always in there. Like it just feels so real and so engaged, both the way he was toward you and the way you were toward him. And I marveled that you were able to get on the page yourself as a kid and as a teenager and this kind of more compassionate perspective of yourself now. So I thought it was remarkable that you were able to write about your young self in the voice of your grown-up self. And I was totally in there with the young self, but also I appreciated the tempering and the perspective of the older self. And I wondered whether it took you a while to get to figure out the voice of the book.
In some ways, I feel I was really grateful that I did not actually start writing this book in earnest until many years later, because by the time I finally wrote the book, I was a parent myself with a young daughter. And even just working on the book and having the young daughter pop in and try to talk to me while I was writing gave me a lot of compassion for what my father had been through. And it really helped me to see him, again, not just in terms as a child might or a young adolescent might, because he died when I was still basically, I was only 21, I was still sort of an adolescent. In a way, our relationship had kind of stalled at this level. And it wasn't really until writing the book that I could try to see him almost as a peer, the way as a grown-up you might reapproach the relationship with your parents and say, I'm so sorry. I kept you up all those nights worrying. I know now how hard that was. I think it takes years of maturity and experience to be able to come to that. So that was something that I could only achieve, you know, over a great distance of time. Mm-hmm. One of the things I really admired in your book was your structure and kind of how you found that structure. And I'll just return to what you were saying earlier about this being a mystery and he left without a clue. His whole life was a clue. And this kind of desire to, even that you, in that first section you read of, he might have been thinking this or he might have been thinking this, and sort of examining all of these points. And it's almost like a maze, the way you're in a large maze and you go on a false direction, then you stop. Okay, it's not there, and you have to go back several steps and go to the beginning, you go take another channel. I felt like your book, it was sort of an unmemoir. You know, a very untraditional memoir in its structure. It's a suicide index, and it's indexed. And that allows you to sort of reflect that experience, to replicate that fragmentary experience. And I just wonder how you finally seized or found that form.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'm a big believer when I'm writing that every story has a form that's the right form for that story. With my father's death, I initially thought, you know, I had been a fiction writer. I'd written a novel, and so I just assumed I was going to write a novel about a family where the father kills himself and what the impact is on the family. And I tried and tried and tried and tried, and it just didn't work. And I think part of why it didn't work was I was trying it in a very conventional novelish way where everybody would have a kind of dawning understanding as the book went along. And the problem was I didn't have a dawning understanding. I had a continual muddle, you know, where I would sort of understand one thing, but then something else would happen, and I would suddenly not understand.
Like, I feel that your knowledge and confidence within fiction allowed you to take these steps that just gave it such a vividness.
You're right. I think I was playing with fictional techniques writing memoir, and I think it worked for suicide because you can't ever have a definitive version of a person or of this thing. And so I think, and you had asked about the index, that actually came very late in the process. I had been working on the book for about 10 years, and I tried to make it a continuous narrative, and then as you pointed out, the nature of the experience was so chaotic and fragmentary. I just decided to throw out this linear manuscript and write in fragments. And once I started writing in fragments, then I felt like I was getting each bit, but I didn't know how to put it together in a way that a reader would feel like. You know what I think about is the National Gallery in Washington. When you walk through that museum, there's sort of this central corridor, and all the galleries are off the corridor. So you always know exactly where you are in the museum, even as you're making your way through it. And I think I intuitively knew that this book needed something like that. I didn't know what it was. But I think when I stumbled on the index, which seemed also like a kind of ridiculously, ironically, orderly way of trying to, you know, there is no way to put this event in order, so let's just plop an index on top of it. I think there's a way that that was intuitively right. But I needed an organizing principle because it was such a chaotic event.
You're listening to a conversation with authors Joan Wickersham and Alicia Abbott, recorded recently at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. We'll have more of their conversation right after a break. Welcome back to The Point. Today we are at the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown for a conversation with authors Joan Wickersham and Alicia Abbott, both of whom have written critically acclaimed memoirs about their fathers they loved and lost too soon.
I feel like we should be reading some of these titles that you have in the... So it would be like suicide, anger about, suicide... speculative possible reason for, you know, it'd be just, but like this, everything sort of in terms of suicide and how it impacted everyone around and all the different, I mean, it's hard to, or, and then you'd even have some chapters would just be like two words. I feel like there was one, maybe you could remember what it was.
Yeah,
it was suicide, years it took not to feel numb, many
yeah.
years, you know, and that was it. That was the chapter, you know, or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you felt this too, but one of the things that's really weird about, you know, when you're writing about a difficult experience, there's a relief when you know you're telling the story in the right way for that story. And I wondered if it felt that way to you too, that people say to me, oh, it must have been so hard to write that book. And it was hard because I couldn't get it right. Mm-hmm. But there was a sort of feeling of such relief when I felt like I was writing it and it felt true to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had that.
Well, I definitely had a shift in terms of how I approached the story, as I said, from earlier in my life to when I finally did sell the book. And part of that was seeing that this event, this experience I'd had, the loss through this disease, was not something that just happened to me. And it was something I always knew in theory, like, yes, many, many people died of AIDS. AIDS broke up many relationships and families. You know, this is a horrible crisis that touched many people in our society. You know, I think I was just so focused on my personal experience. And once I could see that I could maybe tell a story of a larger community, even just a little bit, even just the community of people that my father knew in San Francisco, and I might be able to look up their obituaries and talk with their friends and lovers. And in a way, it helped relieve me because I think that's something that can be really difficult in memoir and approaching memoir is this feeling that you're always, the tension is always on you. And to say, well, it's actually about something that's bigger than me. I'm not just talking about me. I'm not just writing about me, but there's an idea here and there's a larger story I want to tell and I want to get right. That could involve research that's beyond my personal experience. And once I discovered that, you know, I thought everything started flowing from there. You know, and I think, too, also just going back to what we were saying before about stigma, at the time that I was writing the book, our society had changed so much since the 1992 when my father died, in the sense that, you know, suddenly gay marriage was being talked about and voted on. It's something that would never have been conceived of in 1992. The It Gets Better campaign was started by Dan Savage. There just was a general interest and awareness of like, these are stories that are important that we need to think about. But there was still, in my view at that time, very little knowledge of queer history, LGBTQ history in the wider mainstream society. And partly this, even the history of the AIDS crisis, there was so much stigma around AIDS and those that lived through it. And then as a society, that there was kind of a little bit of discomfort around talking about it. And I felt that as a result of that culturally, I felt there was sort of an erasure of that history. And for me personally, I felt like a little isolated in a way in my grief that there was something that people didn't talk about or really acknowledge. And it's changed actually a lot since I worked on the book just in the last 5 years. We've had A Normal Heart, you know, the Larry Kramer movie on HBO. We've had How to Survive a Plague, and we've had the Dallas Buyers Club. I mean, there's actually a lot that's just been coming out in the last few years. But for me, I felt like I wanted to study and explore that community as a way of fighting against that sense of erasure that I felt like was tied to the stigma.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because one of the things I really admired that about the book, you know, that I learned a lot reading your book, but I also felt that you did a beautiful job of writing about a time and a place without doing that sort of thing that people can do sometimes when they're writing about a history where every single incident that happens is relevant to the, do you know what I mean? That every remark that was made in the 60s has Kennedy in it, and every hat was a pillbox hat, and every, you know what I mean? And I thought, what I thought you did a really good job of is recreating what it's like to live through a time without realizing that you're living through a time. It's very poignant toward the end of your book how slowly it really dawned on you that your father had AIDS. And I thought you did a beautiful job of showing how he was trying to be very matter-of-fact with you about, you know, the details of some of his symptoms and medical things that he was doing. He wasn't hiding any of that from you, but at the same time, the full force of it didn't really hit you. And one of the scenes that I thought was just beautiful and devastating was there's a scene, and I hope it's okay to just say it, that there was a scene where you were working in a restaurant in France and you have to quit the job partly because you're going to go home and take care of your father, and there's this kind of cold boss, and you tell her that you're quitting and you say that you're going to go home and take care of your father, which is true, but it's not going to happen as immediately as you make it sound like it's going to happen. And then that's when it breaks upon you that there's this terrible thing happening. And I just thought the way the grief comes out then, I thought you did a really good job of how unexpectedly those things hit us and how we can sort of live with them for a long time before we even really realize what's going on.
Thank you. I mean, it's funny because that reminds me, you're just saying about it breaking. And in your book, one of the big themes was your own numbness, you know, to your father's death, and this kind of this way you would tell your husband, like, I think the ice is breaking, like that you had this feeling of being sort of stuck in ice. And that was something I really related to. You know, and you even talked about, you had a chapter where you were talking about, again, it was sort of indexed as food eaten around, it was sort of all this food that you ate, that you were sort of, were constantly part of your grieving process was eating chocolate brownies that were undercooked and extra gooey, that often all this eating would make you feel these sensations and how you just wanted to feel sensations because it was so hard for you to feel. In the book, I felt like was a layer of suspense. It wasn't just like, well, why did your father do this, which was kind of unknowable and all these things, but like, when is she going to feel? You know, when is she going to react to this? And when does the anger come in? Like, when does the sadness come in and when does the anger come in? And I just feel like that's also something that we can relate with, in that if someone, you know, especially with these stigmatized diseases, there's a feeling sometimes that for a long time those that died of AIDS were, it's like, well, this happened because of your behavior. You know, there was sort of a view that somehow these people were really responsible and brought it on themselves, when they're responsible for us being human, you know, in a way, and being susceptible to something that was wildly, anyway, but, you know, and that similarly with suicide, it's like, well, this is some, you know, who's at fault here? Is it the family that couldn't reach or understand that this person was suffering, or was it this person who couldn't fight back these feelings of, you know, depression? And having to find the place between saying, you know what, this is an illness. I mean, I felt angry at my dad for leaving me, and I felt angry at him for telling me when I was in the middle of college and not ready to hear it, you have to come home and take care of me because there's no one else, and this is, here's how we're going to do it. I'm like, how dare you do that? And it took me actually longer to get to the point where I would say, I mean, I look back at myself with shock at like how selfish I was, or how unable at the time I was to be able to see just how hard it was even for him to have that conversation with me, you know, how much strength that took. And for you, it seemed it was actually you for a long time were wanting to protect him and not be in touch with that anger.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think I felt when my father died that way, that he had given himself the worst punishment possible. So how could I pile on top of that? It is true that these are two illnesses that weren't treated. I mean, I think your father's AIDS happened before the medicine, you know, so I mean, that was something else that is very sad, I think, to read these, to read about these men who, you know, I don't know whether my father ever would have gone to see a psychiatrist or taken, you know, modern antidepressants, and I don't know, he would have seen that as a sign of weakness, and, you know, I don't know whether anyone could have ever talked him out of that, but I do feel that whatever he had was untreated. One last question I have for you is, do you think your father would have liked your book?
Oh,
It's actually so funny that you say that, because as I was reading your book, and there's that part where you said something about you're almost having a conversation. You're looking at sort of the biographer and the person who's being written about, having almost a conversation, saying, did I get it right? And the person saying, no, you didn't get it right. There's no possible way you could get it right. And I thought to myself, as I was reading this, people have asked me all the time in the past, like, what do you think your father would say? And I'm like, oh, he'd think it's great. And I'm like, of course he wouldn't. You know what I mean? Of course there would be ways that I would have failed to tell the whole story. My story is colored by my perception. I tried to do a good job by interviewing people and researching and using his journals to try to create a portrait that felt true to me, but also, you know, complex and rich. But I would have to think that, you know, that he would have been happy for the time I put into it. Meaning, it's so, sort of strange, but in the process of writing the book, I felt like I got to spend time with him and be close with him, because I was studying his journals and reading them in a way I never had before. As a child, I would just scan them looking for my own name. So horrible. But now I could, you know, I was really trying to understand him and approach him with compassion. And I got to spend time with him, and even just recognizing, even in his journals, moments he was sad that he didn't share with me. And just sitting with him and spending that time. So I like to think that he would have been glad that I spent that time with him, you know, that long visit.
Yes.
In a way.
And that's a hard thing, I think, about finishing these books is, you, in a way, it's, you know, you've kind of restored the person by writing about him, but you lose him again when you finish it.
Mm-hmm. So that is hard.
Yeah.
So do you want to, shall we read the final reading?
Yeah. Do you want to go first? Or?
Sure. So I'm just going to read the epilogue. After my father died, the lights in fairyland went dark. I left San Francisco for New York in the hope of rekindling the adult life I had to snuff out when Dad got sick. But the world I rejoined there was mostly young and straight. I could count on one finger the number of friends who'd even met my dad. At first, this was liberating. I could reinvent myself. I could be someone other than daughter. But I also felt this persistent sense of dislocation. With few people to share memories of my father, I had no outlet for my grief. I started to feel as if the life we'd shared existed only in my head. And in the pages of Dad's out-of-print books, his journals, and the letters I ritualistically reread on his birthday and on the anniversary of his death. This disconnect intensified after the introduction of protease inhibitors in the mid-90s, changed AIDS from a death sentence into a manageable disease. Those who hadn't lived through the epidemic would come to know almost nothing of it as a cultural amnesia set in. The heavy, warlike losses of the AIDS years were relegated to queer studies classrooms taught as gay history and not American history. All along, my memories of those years have followed me, along with my father's papers, from an apartment on the Lower East Side to a Brooklyn loft, and finally to the house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that I now share with my husband and two young children. All along, they spoke to me, and I to them, and in the course of that conversation, this book emerged, more by fits than starts. Finally now, nearly 20 years after I first sat down in that closet full of notebooks, the book is written. But something happened along the way. Researching Dad's life, I've made contact with his old colleagues and friends and others we knew, people like Joyce Jenkins from Poetry Flash and Jimmy Siegel, who owns Distractions, and Sean, the smiling Southerner who worked at Coffee, Tea, and Spice in the Hate. Speaking with them, I got to hear three powerful words. Three words I didn't know I so badly needed to hear. I remember you. With these words, the lights switch on, the music plays, the carousel starts up, and those glittery and colorful horses move up and down again, delighting my every sense. For a moment, I get to be a child again, and I feel wholly me. Working late one night with my kids and husband, peacefully sleeping upstairs, I decided for the first time to research the BAR obituary database. The BAR, or Bay Area Reporter, where Dad sometimes covered books and arts, was an important barometer of the AIDS epidemic, the papers dramatically thickening as the numbers of dead increased. Those obituaries are now online, thanks to the GLBT Historical Society, part of a database searchable by name or year. Sitting in my dark home alone, I easily found the obituaries of friends, like Robert, a devout Wagnerian, Tommy, Teddy and Cuddles were by his bedside, Jono, an incredible kisser, a perfect listener, and Sam. Goodbye, my mystery. Then I searched out names from Dad's journals, men I didn't know but who were among his friends. Then I just started browsing, randomly clicking on names, reading stories, and staring at picture after picture of the dead. All of these Peter Pans, young men frozen in their 80s haircuts and sweaters, never to realize the potential of that first book of poetry, that well-received play or generous heart. His friends were his life. And soon I was sobbing, sobbing until my eyes were puffy like a boxer's. I felt battered with grief. How strange, I thought, when the crying finally subsided. I'm not gay. I'm not a member of this generation of men that lost so many friends that whole phone books had to be tossed. This grief, I now realize, has always been with me. I just never located it. This place where Dad and I lived together, our fairyland, wasn't make-believe, but a real place with real people, and I was there. And though I haven't lived in San Francisco since 1994, and though the life I live is very different from the life that I shared with my dad, one he might even consider bourgeois, I am very much a product of his world. Though I am straight and haven't had a living gay parent for almost 20 years, I still feel a part of this queer community. This queer history is my queer history. This queer history is our queer history.
I'm just going to read a little section from a chapter that comes kind of late in the book. The first half of my book is really about the factors, my father and the factors that led up to his death and his death. And then the hardest part to write was the impact of his death on me and on our family. So I'm just going to read a little section from a chapter that's called Suicide, Psychological Impact Of. I checked in for my Paris flight at Logan and sat in a chair drinking tea and doing a crossword puzzle. I got stuck on a clue and looked around the room. My father was sitting across the lounge at the end of a long row of chairs. He was wearing a suede jacket, reading the Times, waiting patiently for his flight to be called. It was different from the other times when I'd spotted him, in the cheese shop, or sitting a few rows ahead of me at a concert, or climbing slowly out of a parked car as I went by, helplessly, in the passenger seat of a moving one. This time, I knew it wasn't him. I was like a veteran of the desert who knows about mirages, but can still be stirred by one, capable of simultaneously discounting and savoring the sight of green trees and a pool of clear water. I sat in the departure lounge looking wistfully over at this guy. Not only did I see him, I understood him. He was living a peripatetic life, flying to and from Europe, where he could travel easily, comfortable in the German of his childhood and the French, Spanish, and Portuguese he spoke so fluently. He was living this other, secret life because he was afraid to come home. I knew I wasn't going to get up and move closer, but I imagined what might happen if I did. I imagined that he would have looked up to stare at me with uncertain, smiling amazement. His cover would have been blown, but we would both have been relieved that I'd blown it. I would have said to him, "It's okay. You don't have to worry anymore. It's safe. The mess you left has all been cleaned up. You can come home now." Thank you all so much.
You've been listening to a conversation with authors Alicia Abbott and Joan Wickersham, recorded May 13th at the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. You can hear this conversation again at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks to Brian Morris, who recorded and edited this program. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.